ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, I'm Sana Qadar, and I host All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. If you've ever wondered why people behave the way they do, or what it's like to live inside their heads, this is the show for you. We dive deep each week into a topic related to mental health or psychology, from the promise and perils of manifesting, to how to get better sleep, to what it's like to experience psychosis. Hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Hello, I'm James Carlton. Welcome to God Forbid on ABC Radio National and across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. It's the panel show about the things we believe and why we believe them. Hard to believe it's December. What a exciting and unpredictable year it's been. You could say we've learned to live with uncertainty. Perhaps next year we may learn what to do with it. Of course, the big news for Christians this year, we had both a new Pope and for the Anglican Communion, the announcement of a new Archbishop of Canterbury. I've done some checking. This has only ever happened once before in the entire history of Christendom. To discuss this, the developments of the year across many areas and a look ahead to the year that's coming, we welcome from our sister programs at ABC Radio National on the God Forbid panel, Meredith Lake from Soul Search, Scott Stevens from The Minefield, Andrew West from the Religion and Ethics Report, and senior producer of Compass, Noel DeBean, the newly appointed head of the ABC's Religion and Ethics Unit. So he goes first. Hey, Noel.
Hello, James. Thank you.
Andrew, welcome.
Always good to come back.
Scott and Meredith, hello.
Hi, everyone from Ardinda Country here in Central Australia.
Hi, it's good to be with you all.
Now, the exciting part I've checked is that the Pope has changed and the announcement of a new Archbishop, that's happened in the same year only once before in all Christian history. The slightly anticlimactic part is that was 12 years ago when Francis became Pope and Justin Welby, Archbishop. But still, it's a historic moment. Sarah Mullaly will be the first woman to be enthroned as the Church of England's senior bishop at Canterbury Cathedral in March. She'll also be the first to publicly identify as pro-choice. And, of course, for Catholics, we know Leo, the first Pope from the United States and from the Order of St. Augustine. We'll talk about both. Let's look especially in Anglicanism, what may be this emerging global schism. But first, Noel, for Roman Catholics, you were in Rome for the ABC, for the conclave. What did that mean for you?
Oh, personally, it was the time of my life. Like, it's all downhill from now, as far as I'm concerned. I was, like, desperately interested in what I was doing. And I was
That's very loaded. You say that as the new boss. It's all downhill from here.
Perhaps that was my inside voice speaking then, and I shouldn't have said it out loud. But to stand in that square when the Pope comes out, having been, like, involved in all of the sort of, how would you put it, the secret gossip and all of the, you know, projections and the leaking out of the general consistories where the cardinals were meeting. I couldn't believe how often it leaked. And we were getting all this information on the ground, so I felt really part of it.
Yeah, and I will just say this, by the way, Noel, you did tell me, keep a certain Robert Prevost on your radar. And he did make a cameo appearance in some of the discussions, but he was not a central character. But I will say this for you. You did tell me very early on, keep Robert Prevost on your radar as the next Pope.
I was pretty happy about that, I've got to say. It's always good to be able to predict it. Like, I've always said, oh, you can't predict the next Pope. Well, it was good to be on the right side with this one.
But he was a dark horse.
he was to us outside because, you know, not everybody understands what the leader of the Dicastery for Bishops is. I mean, he met most of the bishops. Most of the cardinals knew him because of the role he was in. And then it was an Australian who tipped me off about 3 days before saying, now, Noel, you've got to watch him because he speaks Spanish, he speaks Portuguese, he speaks English, he reads German, he speaks some French, he does all of this, and he knows them all. He's got the block from, you know, the Southern American Episcopal Conference because he was a bishop, of course, there. And so he said, he's got a lot of votes there. It's potential. And this is how the sort of the horse race betting was going.
How did the leaks get out when, if that conclave movie is to be believed, there's no, once the doors are closed and the walls go up, there's no penetration?
There's two, there's two stages. There's what are called the general consistories. And the general consistories are when all the cardinals, even the ones who can't vote, are allowed to meet together, and they meet together in the hall just next to St. Peter's, and they talk about what sort of Pope do we want. They listen to 5-minute speeches from each other to try to find out, you know, did anyone pop out there? You know, they were waiting for the speech to work out which one might get it. And so it was during these general consistories that we did what was similar to what Robert Blair Kaiser did, the old Time magazine guy who got all the scoops on Vatican Council. What he did was he and his wife invited a cardinal for dinner. The cardinal brought another cardinal back. Then within weeks, they had everybody at their smorgasbord and they kept tipping the wine. And of course, the cardinals start talking about, oh, well, this is what happened today. And then he'd put it in Time magazine.
In vino veritas.
That's what I said to Geraldine Doogue when we arrived. We're going to have to go to a lot of dinner parties. And this is work, Geraldine. It's work. And it was work. And this is how we got a lot of the leaks at the end of the day. It was amazing how it came out. But it was because the cardinals were talking to their friends, and some of whom were journalists who knew them. And then the journalists would all talk to each other later on, and we go, is that right or not wrong? And it happened in steps.
And Pope Leo finding his voice on his first foreign trip as we speak.
And not unexpected, the choice of the Middle East. Now, it's Turkey, the old Asia Minor, but Lebanon. Interesting, the two countries. First of all, Turkey or Turkia has a Christian population of less than about 1%. It is historically the scene of the great clash between Islam and Christianity. The old Byzantine capital, the old Orthodox capital known as Constantinople, and at the center of it, what was once a church, Hagia Sophia, now becoming a mosque under Erdogan, and a mosque that is used on a regular basis, not simply a museum. He met the ecumenical patriarch Bartholomew, who's the leader of about 250 million Orthodox Christians, again cementing a relationship that Pope Francis helped to build up, although previous popes had met the ecumenical patriarch. Then going to Lebanon. Lebanon, very significant because it's the country with the biggest, the Middle Eastern country with the biggest Christian population. About a third of the country, about a third of Lebanon is Christian. Not all of them Catholic. There are many Christian denominations there, but principally the Maronites, which is an Eastern Rite church or an Eastern church in communion with the Catholic, with the Vatican. And the message there from Leo has been essentially one of coexistence, and he's carried that over into his discussion about Israel and Gaza. His ultimate message there about coexistence being a two-state solution is the only option, acknowledging that Bibi Netanyahu and the current hardliners oppose a two-state solution. But it was a pointed choice for his first visit, and it was a pretty stark message that he gave.
Can I just pick up a point there?
Please, Scott Stevens.
So I'm glad that Andrew raised the point about coexistence, because it is striking, isn't it, that one of the central themes of Leo's papacy so far has been not just the danger that certain forms of technology pose to humanity. I mean, in many respects, he has been the anti-AI pope. And in that, I think he's, in many respects, he's been at his most articulate. But he's also the pope that has been most vocal, I think, about the dangers of polarization and the dangers of the acceptance of polarization as, if you like, the grammar of politics, if you like, the cost of doing business with politics around the world. The very emphasis on the theme of learning to overcome these differences, or if not overcoming them, tarrying with one another long enough and refusing not to kill one another in the process. You know, it is just interesting to go back to the conclave itself and to recognize that Pope Leo's American origins, his origins in Chicago, weren't so much a benefit for him. They weren't a tick in his box. It was rather something that many of the cardinals, in fact, had to overcome. The fear being that there'd be too much centralization of power, of influence, too much American or Americanized rhetoric. And I think in many respects, one of the ways that Pope Leo has been able to distance himself from the Trump administration, from any kind of imputation of undue influence or American centrism, it's not just his extensive kind of pastoral experience in South America, but it's also been the way that he's been willing, particularly on the issue of immigration and the proper treatment of migrants, legal or not, the way that he's been able to try to soften some of the hard edges of the political rhetoric that we've now taken as just part of the price of doing democratic business.
Yeah, and I've got to say, though, it's also extraordinary to hear a Pope, though, in a broad Chicago accent saying, holy God, holy God.
Well, can I jump in there? Because on the election day, when he came out, the crowd, they announced him, you know, Bortem Franciscum Prevoste, and the crowd went, Like, the crowd didn't know who he was. And they were actually a bit hostile. And then he came out and spoke Italian. Then they all started cheering. And I turned to Giacomo, our camera, and said, what happened there? And he went, well, because they looked really unhappy that this guy had been elected. And they were saying, Trump's done this. This is Trump. He's ruined the election. This is what's happened. And then Giacomo said to me, well, he speak the Italian, a little bit Spanish accent, but very good Italian. They're happy now. And you forget that he's the Bishop of Rome, of course. The Romans all want somebody who can understand them and speak their language. And even from that moment, though, the rumors were swirling that this was somehow an American fix. And as Scott just pointed out, he's moved away from that dialogue that started off. The conspiracy theories were everywhere at first.
I think one of the signals of his intention to push back against the polarization of our times is actually his choice of name, that he's, you know, he's not Pope Bob, he's Pope Leo, a choice of name that harks back to the Pope whose famous encyclical was on the rights of capital and labor, written in the 1890s at a time of real kind of economic unrest and distress for many parts of the world. And I think that's one of the interests that in some ways he carries on from Pope Francis, his predecessor, whose concern for the poor was renowned and also really thoroughly integrated in a lot of his social teaching, including on climate and ecology. And in my mind, one of the big and most important questions about what Pope Leo, the kind of leadership he will offer the world, is to do with how he will embed or extend Pope Francis's legacy, spelled out in Laudato Si, his world-shaping encyclical on the care of our common home, released back in 2015. I mean, I'm sitting here in the Northern Territory where we had 24 days in a row of heat wave warnings, the hottest October on record, with average temperatures nearly 3 degrees above the long-term average for this part of the country. Last year was the hottest year on record, globally speaking. 2025 is going to be in the top 2 or 3 hottest years on record. This is a really urgent issue affecting every living thing on the face of the earth. And Pope Francis really made a mark by speaking into that space on the grounds of the traditions of Catholic social thought, integrating it, as I said, with his concerns around economic equity, technology, as you've mentioned, Scott, and all those things. And I think in the year when not only Pope Francis died, but Jane Goodall and other kind of heroes of attention, really, to our place in that wider community of life, one of the big issues for the new Pope and for all of us, arguably, is how we will attend to our creaturely nature and what that means for how we cohabit, how we coexist on this planet, on this pale blue dot.
I think you're exactly right. One of the things that Leo is already seeming willing to do is to try to consolidate, to try to institutionalize, to try to incorporate many of the themes that he wants to place stress on. And that's why there's been this remarkable convergence in his critiques about what AI is doing to human life, to human interiority and culture, our sense of beauty, our sense of aesthetics. But he's also almost unique among religious leaders. He's also been placing the emphasis on the environmental degradation that AI, that the demand for AI, the vast data centers, the thirst, the lust for fresh water is also going to be imposing. I mean, by 2027, we're expecting that something like 6.4 trillion liters of water are going to be required by AI data centers. That's over half of what the UK consumes in water a year. So again, it's interesting to me that Leo has really placed the emphasis not just on the human costs of these things, but also the unseen, unacknowledged institutional and environmental costs that AI is also going to be exerting on our lives.
It's a good point you make there, Scott, can I say, because he is, the Augustinian thing is a thing. They're contemplatives, they're semi-contemplative, and this is part of the process he goes through, reflection, contemplation, then discussion in the world, and that includes things like AI, it includes all the sorts of things he does.
On ABC Radio National, this is God Forbid. I'm James Carlton. We're with Meredith Lake from Soul Search, Scott Stevens from The Mindfield, Andrew West from the Religion and Ethics Report, and Noel DeBean from Compass. We are looking at the year gone by and the year ahead, discussing artificial intelligence. The promise is that it'll simultaneously master every field of human knowledge, from quantum mechanics to medieval literature, such as the capacity once it reads every book written, every newspaper article posted, finding connections that no single mind could ever hold together, and potentially solving some of our greatest challenges. In October on God Forbid, I actually spoke with Michael Muthukrishna from the London School of Economics. He's an expert on the emerging technology of artificial intelligence. Let's have a listen to what he told me.
I think that these machines, by virtue of sucking up the cultural corpus of all that humanity has created, can see patterns that would take us a very long time to discover.
If ever.
If ever, yeah. So I think, you know, humans working alongside machines can get there. And whenever we're in the early days of something, we get caught between kind of hype and hysteria. You know, I sometimes describe this as being caught between Socrates and Edison. So, you know, Socrates was really, really worried that the invention of literacy was going to cause us to lose our memories because we'd begin to write things down. He was very worried about literacy. He felt that people would lose their memories because they'd be storing things on paper, and they would have the semblance of understanding because they weren't receiving it from another human being. Right? He's very worried about this. And the irony is we only know about these concerns because Plato, of course, wrote it down. So that's the kind of hysteria we're seeing with AI today. On the other hand, you had hype, right? So Thomas Edison in 1913, he had an interview where he said, I've invented this new thing that is going to do away with books in schools within 10 years. Within 10 years, nobody's going to need books anymore. You can look up the actual interview. You know, Edison was the Elon Musk of his time. He was the greatest technologist. He was the Sam Altman, the Bill Gates, or whomever you like, Steve Jobs. What he was referring to was the moving picture. He was talking about videos. And he had made all of these videos, educational videos, and he said, my God, this is what's going to replace books. Now, videos, of course, used in classrooms throughout the world today, but we still need to read. So that's the kind of hype cycle. And AI is in that kind of caught between these two spaces where AI is going to destroy everything versus AI is going to save humanity.
Michael Muthukrishna, speaking on God Forbid last October. Meredith Lake, are you in the hype or hysteria side?
I've got to say, I'm contemplating my resolutions for the new year, James, and staying as AI sober as I can is close to top of the list for me. I have to say I'm really wary. I think partly because of the potential implications for our ecological footprint, as Scott was saying earlier. Fresh water is at such a premium. I live in the arid zone, so it's front of mind for me. I have real concerns around what is required to sustain the explosive expansion of this technology. But I think in terms of the kinds of things I'm interested in exploring on Soul Search, what kind of presence we have towards one another, how do we simplify our lives and kind of move to something deeper than a consumption-driven sense of self. For me, that's what I'm interested in, and I guess I'm very ambivalent about how helpful or otherwise so-called generative AI is in that enterprise. That said, I'm fascinated by the ways we often embrace a religious language to talk about game-changing technologies like this. Will they save us? Will they redeem us from our problems? Or are they going to condemn us to some kind of hell? So as a cultural artifact, I'm very curious, but at the same time, I guess I'm yet to be convinced that anything will ever adequately replace or augment the genuine attention of one human being to another in care spaces, in families, in communities. And that's, I guess, what I hope we can retain an interest in and a capacity for as a society and on and in local communities.
Hmm. Andrew West?
Well, I've always been a techno-skeptic and proudly so. Something that Michael said there in that grab leapt out at me where he said, and he posited it as a good thing, you know, we can suck up the entire corpus of human knowledge. I don't know that I want to know everything, and I don't know that I want to take the mystery out of the world. I don't know. There's an arrogance that AI embodies, that we should and deserve to know everything at our fingertips without any process of exploration, without the human interactions that are required. AI assumes that every fact should be known and available regardless of the circumstance. And I find that depersonalizing. And as I say, it takes the mystery out of life. Life should always be a constant process of exploration and discovery, not at your fingertips, not with convenience has become, I think, a very corrosive factor to the character and to the soul. The convenience of being able to press an app and have a pizza delivered to you, usually by some exploited poor worker, in 20 minutes. Convenience, I think, is a very corrosive phenomenon, corrosive to the soul, corrosive to the character, and I deeply worry about AI and its capacity for depersonalizing the world and stripping our world of mystery.
I mean, in certain fields, I'm a fan, I have to say. I'm thinking more about in medical diagnostics, for example. I think there is incredible gains to be made with the appropriate application of various technologies, AI included. But I guess a question I have is, can we retain the ability to distinguish between knowledge and what we might call wisdom? And what are the resources that we need to pursue that? Not just information, but that's the challenge of our time. And I think you're right, it's not just the gap between the person who benefits from convenience and the worker who has to make it possible, but the digital divide in terms of access to these technologies. How do we take up these new tools in ways that bring us closer together, that don't just amplify, you know, the inequities that we already see around us?
If technology and science is about ending human pain and suffering, or ending the pain and suffering of any sentient being, I'm all for it. If it's about relieving people of the backbreaking tasks that made life a misery, I'm all for it. But if technology is simply about the convenience of communication, and taking, you know, the mildest effort out of life, I think it's very corrosive. So yes, more technology, more science to end pain and suffering, but let us put the brakes on a technology that strips us of our humanity and simply makes everything a bit more easier.
I do think we need to be very careful here, though. And, you know, we are in many respects, just among us, we're rehearsing many of the arguments we are all hearing around us all the time, which is, well, I suppose you would have, you know, been against the invention of the telephone or against the invention of the printing press. Or, you know, we're not really talking, I think, about progress versus non-progress, about technology versus non-technology. As Meredith, I think, was gesturing towards, we are talking about technologies that can have very specific applications in very specific areas of life that could be amazingly beneficial. Part of the problem here is that the ambition of not just AI, but the longing for, the search for AGI, artificial general intelligence, something that is going to solve the problem of human life on the planet as such, that's going to yield all things to our fingertips, as Andrew said, you know, with not just ultimate convenience, but also convenience that settles into the background, so it lulls us into a state of unthinkingness. We no longer reflect about what it is we're doing. There is something about the scale of this technological ambition that goes by the name of AGI that I think is really troubling here. You know, the idea of vacuuming up, of absorbing essentially everything without distinction. You know, one of the moments, James, for me that really made my heart sink was upon first learning the news that Meta, as a way of advancing its own AI ambitions, because of some of the copyright challenges it was already facing, planned on buying Simon and Schuster, for God's sake, in order to absorb this huge kind of trove of words in order to train its large language models.
Would you rather they just use the books without buying the copyright?
I mean, obviously I'd prefer for people to be reading the books in the first place, but the idea that what we want is just language, words, it doesn't matter if it's Simon and Schuster's back catalog or if it's millions of hours of transcribed YouTube videos, all we want is the word. It's the flattening out of value. And what that then does to our ability to discern what matters, what is of greatest value for us. You know, one of the things that the great Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard warned way back in the 1840s was that too many forms of exposure to words, to mass manufactured words, and here he meant the popular press. Too much exposure to mass manufactured words was going to hollow out the human capacity for interiority. And what he meant by interiority is being able to sit with what you don't know, to be able to sit with words or facts or stories or books, and to be able to linger with those things until you've accommodated yourself to them, so that when you speak, you can take responsibility for what it is you say. He said the opposite, when we lose the capacity for interiority, what you then gain is the capacity for chatter. And is there ever a word that defines the process of mass production of words that we're living in at the moment than just chatter?
And you know what Kierkegaard would prescribe for the world, or what he said he would at the time when he lived.
Throwing all journalists in prison is what he said.
Well, silence.
That's right.
Silence.
That's right. Sorry.
Which is the opposite of the kind of the text, generative kind of tech that we are hurtling towards, or that we already live with, frankly. Mm. But I think that this assumption that underpins so much of what we're talking about, that data is somehow neutral. I remember speaking, this was a couple of years ago on Soul Search, to a data scientist, I think she was with the CSIRO at the time, who told me about returning to the village where her mother had grown up in the north of Pakistan, in turn to visit her grandmother's grave. And her grandmother was buried under her grandfather's name. So even at the point of death, her grandmother's whole identity had been subsumed into that of her husband. There is no textual trace of that woman's life in the world. The data set from that cemetery does not recognize her, the fullness of her humanity, or the life that she lived. And for the data scientist I was speaking to, the grandmother of this woman, who was at the forefront of thinking through the kind of the equity and inclusion issues around the data that we use to train these language models, that was a really chastening and sobering story. It has stayed with me for years, obviously, but there's so much that can't be reduced to words in our human experience, let alone the experience of the other things we share this world with. And remaining humble in the face of not only mystery, but our own limits, I just wonder if that actually will turn out to be really useful to us as we navigate whatever the future holds.
Meredith, you must write a blog about that poor grandmother so she can be remembered.
Yes.
Once the AI sucks up your blog, of course.
On some meta platform, ideally.
I point people, just before we leave this, to a brilliant new book that's come out by Paul Kingsnorth, who is an environmentalist and anyways a spiritualist now, converted to Eastern Orthodoxy. It's called Against the Machine. It's a brilliant exploration of how we're pushing up and trying to overcome what should be certain natural limits, and ultimately to our own disadvantage, I think.
And Andrew, while we're in the vein of book recommendations, can I also mention one of the most important AI-related books of the year was Karen Howe's remarkable book, Empire of AI, which is not just on the human cost of AI, but also the folly of certain forms of the pursuit of AGI and the environmental costs surrounding it.
And for those who like fiction, I've just read Playground by Richard Powers.
Yes.
That is, in terms of a fictional exploration of these precise issues, definitely one for the summer reading list.
The only thing I would add is, you know, in terms of the existential significance of AI, is when AI assistant asks you something and you find yourself going down a rabbit warren and not getting anything you want. And that is one of the things that makes me most upset in life, is the lack of the human being there with the sense or the intuition to know where you want to go.
Yeah, but the intuition will come. It's coming. on ABC Radio National, this is God Forbid. We're with Andrew West, Meredith Lake, Scott Stevens and Noel DeBean.
Thank you.
Look, in March next year, the bishops of the Conservative Anglican Future Conference, or GAFCON, they've been summoned to meet in Nigeria. This could well be one of the most eventful Anglican assemblies in history. Andrew West, you've been covering developments on this all year. Why is this important?
Because with the coming of a new Archbishop of Canterbury, Dame Sarah Mullally, until recently the Bishop of London, now the nominal spiritual leader of 80 to 85 million Anglicans around the world, there's a schism that has now looks irreparable. The group called GAFCON, the Global Anglican Futures Conference, which has its roots actually in the Conservative Diocese of Sydney, Anglican Diocese of Sydney, but is now principally an African-based and Global South organization, has simply said they do not accept Sarah Mullally as their new leader. Partly it is because they feel that she has an attitude that is too permissive on questions of sex and sexuality and gender. There's another agenda, though, that they simply cannot accept a woman Archbishop of Canterbury. They are divided, though. The Churches of Africa, while united around a conservative or smaller orthodox view of sex and sexuality, are divided on the question of gender and female priests. They're at least two of the major African countries, they have women bishops.
Like
so there
Kenya.
Is, yeah, like Kenya. So there is, and I think Tanzania has women bishops as well. So there is a division there. But as a general principle, they say she simply embodies what they see as this inexorable race towards liberalism in the Anglican Church. And they've said we're not going to pay our dues, like literally pay our dues to Canterbury, which is what Anglican dioceses do around the world. A small amount of money goes to Canterbury. They're not going to do that. They won't recognize the Lambeth Conference, which is the 10-year gathering of all the Anglican bishops in the world. They won't recognize that as a symbol of unity. They say we are now the inheritors and the bearers of Anglicanism and Anglican orthodoxy.
And just explain, the relationship of global Anglicanism to the former British Empire and how it's a first among equals role?
Well, it's not a papal role. I mean, that is the point. The Archbishop of Canterbury is not a pope. The Archbishop of Canterbury sits, as you've said, as the first among equals of the world's Anglican bishops. It is, in a way, a kind of chairmanship of the world's Anglican community. The Supreme Governor of the Anglican Church, of the Church of England, is the monarch, King Charles. Most Anglican dioceses around the world now are independent of the Church of England, but they say that they are in communion with the Church of England, except now with this dramatic break that we've seen from GAFCON, saying we simply don't recognize the new leadership of the Church.
So in some dioceses, which are part of the Anglican communion in the world, they solemnize same-sex marriages. In other dioceses, not even women are allowed to be
clergy.
That's
correct. I mean, their biggest problem has always been with the Episcopal Church in the United States, which is, by its own admission, an extremely liberal church. Now, that has come at a cost in some respects to the Episcopal Church in the United States. It's got 1.5 million baptized members and I think active members. This is in a country of 330 million. The Episcopal Church has maybe about 900,000 active members around the country. So their liberalism has come at a cost to them, but they say that these were stands that they took based on their reading of theology. But the point about it is that the fracture line within the worldwide Anglican communion now seems unbridgeable. And you'll have places like Australia increasingly under the influence of the conservative Sydney Anglican Diocese, under tremendous stress, because most Anglican bishops in Australia will want to be in communion with the Archbishop of Canterbury. But they will come under enormous stress in the coming decades to, if not sever that connection, to almost place it in a kind of stasis. And I see trouble ahead for Anglicans in Australia in particular.
I would say, because of the particular nature of Sydney Diocese and its influence within the world, it's important to note that there's different types of evangelical in Australia. Mm. So Melbourne is not the same as Sydney, is not the same as, you know, Darwin, is not the same as Armidale, etc. There are types of evangelical. So it's not just a Sydney block. And the same thing happens in GAFCON. In GAFCON, there are different types. Some of them are high church, some of them mid church, some of them are evangelicals, but they're sort of coalescing around a principle of, you know, biblical correctness and, you know, staying faithful to a biblical idea. And part of what's going to happen in Australia is there going to be a debate about who owns the property. This is what will happen. Who is the real Anglican? The GAFCON says we're the real Anglicans, and then the Anglican community says no, we're the real Anglicans, and the Australian Church has a constitution for the Anglican Church of Australia, which implies things about England and the monarch and the Church of England.
It is required to be in communion with the Archbishop of Canterbury.
There are other sections of it that say these things notwithstanding. So yes, there will be an argument over that too.
So could this end up in the courts, a property dispute?
It could. It's been said for years. Could be a bogeyman. But
I'm not sure, though, that even conservative Anglicans in Australia want to have these matters decided in a civil court. I think, in a typical sort of Anglican way, there'll just be a lot of ambiguity, but it will also be accompanied by a lot of bitterness, and that is the sadness in all of this.
I remember, Scott, you were saying something yesterday about a feminized Anglicanism.
Yeah. So look, this is tricky. It's also incredibly sad on so many levels. The appointment of Dame Sarah Mullally is a very interesting one. It's a very significant one. It also feels like, what's the term, a solution to a domestic problem that is then meeting with international opposition. Also, there are simply deep, deep rifts. There are ongoing problems within the Church of England in England that a safe pair of administrative and pastoral hands like Sarah Mullally answers. And then there are theological and interpretive questions that, of course, her appointment exacerbates. And one of the interesting things I think we are witnessing around the world, it is kind of sad to acknowledge that on certain theological and interpretive questions, and by interpretive I mean how to read the Bible, how do we understand what a certain plain reading of certain texts might mean? How do we try to get behind things and know what's binding and what's not? How do we reconcile biblical texts with theological interpretation, with ethical teaching, and so on? You know, one of the things that we are recognizing is that many of those fault lines that have run through various forms of Christianity, and it's not just about gender and sexuality, it's also about the status of other religions. It's other about the status of other peoples, the relationship between Christianity and Judaism, for instance, between Christians and the Jews, to use sort of older language. You know, all of these things that have been kind of lingering beneath the surface, that have been papered over by forms of mutual accommodation or by means of various forms of hermeneutical or theological gymnastics, a lot of these unresolved issues are simply roaring back to the surface. The fractures that have been lingering are now being exposed once again. And so one of the things, for instance, that we are witnessing is at a time when certain expressions of Christianity in the West have been regarded by certain groups as being too liberal, too accommodationist, filled with too many women on the pews and not enough men. We've seen the resurgence of certain forms of chest-beating, highly masculinized Christianity that are trying to appeal to disaffected men, people who feel as though culture has kind of left them behind and made their views and their sense of themselves, you know, things that mustn't ever be spoken. And unfortunately, one of the things that's also gone hand in hand with that is forms of, let's call it Christian nationalism or certain forms of racialized Christianity. And that then has led to new forms of political alignment between certain forms of Christianity and certain highly divisive political ideology. So, you know, everywhere we look at the moment, there are these fractures that are opening up. And instead of Christianity being a kind of conciliatory mode of being together, form of association that can help overcome many of these divisions, it has become yet another one of the forms of division that then's widening not just into social fracture, but also in certain places, outright violence.
rather than communion, basically, which is the pulling together of things.
Let me go. Well, Scott, those fractures and divides that are generating very strange theological and political bedfellows within Christianity, I suggest, have emerged this year and will continue next year with world Judaism or Jewry. Let's turn to Gaza, because the Zionist Israeli historian Yuval Noah Harari, he famously said that this year may be the biggest turning point in Jewish history since the Romans destroyed the Second Temple, 2,000 years ago. He says Judaism has survived every catastrophe imaginable, even the Holocaust, but it has never faced what it faces now, which is a spiritual catastrophe, because, Israel economically strong, militarily strong, will likely remain so. But Harari says the ethnic cleansing of Gaza and the West Bank and the collapse of Israeli democracy could void Jewish culture and 2,000 years of thinking. And that's what has never happened before. Noel Debien, what do you say?
I understand, and I've been fascinated by the interior movements within Judaism, which argue different things. Whether we're talking about the ultra-Orthodox saying Israel doesn't have a right to exist, should never have existed, because, we have to wait till the Moshiach, the Messiah comes, and that's when it will happen. And so this state's a fake state. You get that thing in Judaism, and you see this huge range of views all the way down to some of the extremists who say every child should be killed because they'll grow up into be an Arab and we have to cleanse the land. You get all this thing.
You're talking about the Amalek.
The Amalek thing.
Response to.
And this has been used, the Amalek thing, the idea of the ultimate enemy of Israel. Netanyahu uses it, and it has gone into the dialogue. And so, the question is, to my mind, in the end, for those of us outside, we have to be careful, like terribly careful, or we are accused of anti-Semitism if we criticize certain aspects of Israeli behavior. But it seems to me, yes, this historian is right, that there is an existential crisis inside, and you hear Jews talking about it already. They're doing it very publicly.
Yeah, I think, we really have to be careful here, I think, on a number of points. Number one, I don't think it's accurate to say, as Noval Harari has done, that Israeli democracy has collapsed. It hasn't.
Well, it depends how you define it and depends where you bound it. Insofar as the Israeli polity extends to the Jordan River, there are a couple of million people who don't get to vote. That's not very democratic.
No. I'm not saying it's a model democracy, but I'm also saying that there are certain forms of safeguards that still exist within the democracy, and there are ongoing interior struggles within Israel to try to reclaim, to try to purify that democracy of corruption, and to aim for a more an increasingly and properly democratic state. One of the really complicated issues I think we're facing here is that in these peculiarly morally and geopolitically fraught times, there is a peculiarly crass and many would say even corrupt government in Israel. One that is constitutionally, in terms of its own makeup and in terms of the accommodations that it's made to the extreme right, one that is constitutionally incapable of confronting some of these challenges in a matter that is going to be moral, much less democratically or legally justifiable. All of these things, that line of criticism, I think, is wide open. And many people have leapt into that breach and said, these are not forms of politics. These are not forms of behavior, military action that can be justified legally, morally, or so on. But for that then to become the platform upon which, again, we were talking about lingering fault lines before, the great lingering fault line, that of anti-Semitism, can then burst out into the open and then receive new forms of approbation, or even people just humoring it again, using language that was impossible, it was unthinkable just a decade and a half ago. Some of that has to do with the online ecosystems that then give voice to things that should only ever be in the shadows or not belong to human conversation at all. And some of these are part of a form of geopolitical or political opportunism, using the cover of the frankly despicable behavior of the state of Israel
to be able to give voice to things about Jews in general, the influence of Jews, or what obligation America should have to the Jews, or should Christians continue to accommodate Jews any further? You know, all of these things have become open season. Some of that has to do with our political culture and online culture. Some of it is just rank opportunism, and some of it is the particular geopolitical conditions in which we find ourselves.
I think what you're touching on there, Scott, is this extraordinary split that's emerging in the US right, where, you know, half the MAGA movement is staunchly pro-Israel, but there's an emerging strand of it which is very anti-Israel. And then on the left as well, you get young Jews for Mamdani, Jews under 50 who will in great numbers identify as not Zionist, who will consider Israel apartheid. This happens in among British Jewry as well. And there's no going back. This is a post-Gaza phenomenon. It's not as if, you know, getting rid of Netanyahu and returning to some 1970s style Israeli Labour government will make people forget Gaza, that there is no going back.
Israel's major problem is that it's squeezed between two visions. First of all, most of the world now wants Israel to have an accommodation with the Palestinians. Most of the world now seeks a two-state solution. If Israel won't accommodate a two-state solution, the only option it's got is to enfranchise the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. That poses its own problem to Israel's Jewish identity. So it's got that pressure from its left. On its right, though, and you've raised it here, James, there's a very nasty movement online in the United States called the Groyper Movement. And Rod Dreher, a really thoughtful conservative commentator, has raised the alarm about this because the Groypers are followers of a guy called Nick Fuentes. And he is a full-blown anti-Semite. And he has a huge following among young Republicans.
And so, he was interviewed and legitimized by?
By Tucker Carlson, you know, who I hadn't thought of as being an anti-Semite, and still says that he wasn't, but he didn't challenge Fuentes in this discussion. But the point here is that an Israeli government that places all its eggs in the basket of a Republican administration in the United States is going to find itself facing a real shock if this anti-Israel and indeed anti-Jewish sentiment continues to grow among the younger sections of the Republican right. You know, I would say, the challenge for the Israeli polity, regardless of whether Netanyahu is in power or not.
This is what Harari, I think, was getting at. When Jewry ceases to do what it's done for 2,000 years, which is to align itself with the politics of the downtrodden, being downtrodden themselves, but then in alliance with the muscular ethno-nationalism, the kind we see with Trump, the kind we see with Modi, the kind we see with Orban. That may work well in the short term, but as we see with the hard right in America turning against Jews, it doesn't work well for Jews in the long run.
The response for many Jews, especially after 7th of October, 2023, is that that kind of disposition is what got us to this moment. Now, I mean, I would say that that's a wrong reading of what it is that got the nation to that horrifying, massacring moment. But there is a, you know, there is also a great deal of grief that many Jews across the world are feeling when they look at Israel, when they look at the stance that it's taken, the uncompromising, chest-beating, militaristic, flexing its muscle in an already fraught region. I mean, there is something about, you know, a sense of lingering loyalty and even love for the nation, an outright despair over what it is that it's doing. So you have that on the one hand. I do feel that I just need to say, because we haven't mentioned it up to this point, a good deal of the Groyper movement is both Orthodox aligned and Catholic aligned. There are a good many people who are now reconciling virulent anti-Semitism with adopting their membership in churches that have long struggled with anti-Semitism and that are now aligning that particular anti-Jewish prejudice with a form of Christiano-Western supremacy that, I mean, this is one of the things that Rod Dreher also does, that needs to be called out whenever and wherever we see it.
The question of spiritual crisis, I wonder if it actually extends beyond the Jewish community to the human community in many ways. Earlier this year, I interviewed a Palestinian doctor who has lived all her life within the state of Israel and works as a medic within the Israeli healthcare system, and also is now the head of an Israel-based NGO called Physicians for Human Rights. And that was among the first Israel-based organisations to describe the catastrophe in Gaza as a genocide. And Dr. Lina Qasem Hassan rushed to set up clinics to treat the victims of the October 7 attacks, having been prevented from running her regular clinics in Gaza as a result of those attacks. And the conversation I had with her about the challenge of perceiving any person as a human being and treating them, recognizing that everyone in different ways and in different degrees is traumatized by what's happened and is still happening, was one of the most powerful conversations that I've had in years, actually. And to realize that whatever the political responses, the online takes might be, and they matter, this is a catastrophe for a region and for the globe that has a face, that has tens of thousands of faces, that has traumatized a generation of children in Gaza and beyond, that we will be reckoning with for years and years and years. And whatever the future or otherwise of the political careers of the major players may be, I think that is something that has really affected me and moved me, thanks to people like Lina Hassan. But this is, I would say, a spiritual crisis beyond something internal to Judaism in all its diversity, but one that I think poses deeply challenging questions for the global community in political ways, but on that human level of how do we respond to the suffering of others, and what now? I don't think there's a two-state solution or whatever the politics of it might be. What is our answer to that? And I think that's a question to sit with for a long time from now.
If I would try to put my finger on one thing which could be part of this whole idea of a crisis, it's what it means to be the chosen people, and what does that look like, and how do you express that, and how does it relate to other peoples? Because there's been a long history of anti-Semitism between Christians and Jews, and that's just a fact. And in the last decades, there have been attempts to try to fix that relationship. And one of the things that is in the dialogue is what it means to be the chosen people. Who are they? Does it extend beyond the Jewish people? Do the Noahide laws? I remember being taught lots of things by Peter Pellack about the Noahide laws and how Judaism relates with Christians. And I'm not seeing her voice loudly represented as this sort of conflict goes on, yet she was is a peacemaker. And I think she was on the program too, wasn't she, Meredith? Am I remembering correctly?
On a different episode, but yes, Peter Pellach and Riman Barakat, who is a Palestinian artist. Again, that was another of the conversations I've had this year that has really stayed with me, giving me and all of us really an insight into the grassroots peace movement and the degree of dissatisfaction with this situation on all sides. But the question of peace is a positive good that communities strive for together. They're the voices that I'm interested in hearing. Yeah. And I think it's going to take a long time.
Well, those voices certainly were on your episode of Soul Search. It was hopeful, but heartbreaking. That brings us to the end of what is the final show of God Forbid this year. We will be giving you our summer season in the weeks ahead. However, I do want to thank our special panel very much. Meredith Lake from Soul Search. Thank you, Meredith.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Meredith in Alice Springs in our Brisbane studio. Scott Stevens from The Minefield. Thank you, Scott.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Andrew West from the Religion and Ethics Report. Thank you, Andrew.
Always good to be here.
And Andrew's angry boss is Noel Debien, a new editor of Religion and Ethics Unit at the ABC. Thank you, sir. You're doing a really, really good job.
I think I need a Xanax.
On that note, we have reached the end of God Forbid. Thank you for your company this episode and this year. I'm James Carlton. Until next week, remember to be good. This has been God Forbid.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.